man walked with God and God dwelt with them, you could say that they were God's people and that God dwelt among them. What changed that situation?
Sin.
And what was, there was a, just the beginning of a hint and a promise made about the woman that someone would come and repair the damage done by sin. What was that promise? Through her seed, right, would come someone to bruise or to crush Satan's head, right? What, from the point of the sin in the garden till about Genesis chapter 6, what was the condition, what happened to mankind?
Progressively
worse and worse. And what did God do? Basically, we could call it the recreation, but we usually call it the flood. God destroyed the world. He saved one family by water. Okay, and they were on the ark for about a year. They came off the ark, and God made a promise. What was the promise? Never destroy it by water again. And we all know this from being children. What was the sign? The rainbow, right? Then God gave them a commandment. He told them to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. But we find, in terms of text, it happened pretty quickly. But over time, what did man do? Did he follow that commandment? What did he do? Obviously, but what sin did mankind commit? Well, they built a tower, right? And they didn't scatter. So what did God do? Yeah, he messed up their languages, essentially. And they scattered throughout the earth, and they fulfilled his purpose, which was to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. It's interesting, it's the exact same command that he gave to Adam and Eve. Well, at that point, we have followed the history of all of mankind. And what could we say about that history?
Not much change.
Yeah, not much change. So the narrative then begins to focus on one family. And who is that one family? Well, we're going to say Abraham, but it's really the descendants of Terah, right? Because it focuses a bit on Abraham and Lot at the beginning. But God appears to Abraham, and he makes him some promises. What were those promises? Okay.
The land promise.
And through his seed, all nations of the earth will be blessed. By the way, that's basically the second time that God is beginning to reveal how he's going to save mankind. So, you know, Shane said that really what he wanted us to see in this series is, where do you see Jesus in this? Well, those two, that promise made to Adam and Eve and the promise made to Abraham that through his seed all nations of the earth would be blessed, is that thread, right? Well, what do we see then for the rest of Genesis? Well, we're basically following that family. And we go through Abraham, get to Isaac, and what does God do for Isaac? He repeats those promises again. He comes to Jacob, he repeats those promises again. And then the story kind of diverts, because one of the things that Abraham was told, that he would not get the land, or his descendants would not receive that land, until his people had gone off into Egypt and been mistreated by them, and the time of the Amorites would be fulfilled. Okay? Now, Abraham may not have understood all that, but what we see is Joseph leading the people into Egypt. And then They are there, and Joseph dies. And we pick up in Exodus, and the narrative picks up with who? Moses. And what is Moses? He is a type of Christ because of what he does. What is it that Moses does? He gives the law. He leads them out of slavery and bondage, which when Jesus leads us out of slavery and bondage, what is he leading us out of? Sin, right? And he also is a... And Moses received a covenant, and in that sense gave it to the children of Israel. But Jesus received a covenant from God, and he gave it to all who believe in him. Okay? Well, what do the people promise when they get to Mount Sinai? We will believe, even before they've even heard what he's got to say, whatever he says, we will do it. Then Moses goes up, gets the Ten Commandments, comes back down, reads them to them, and what do they say? We'll do them. And how long does that last? Yeah, about 40, right? Yes. They build a golden calf. Moses has to plead with God, which is a type of Christ, for them that they would not be destroyed. Then they go to receive the land promise, which, by the way, at Mount Sinai, the great people promise, or your descendants will be as numerous as the sand on the seashore or the stars in heaven. That was fulfilled when they were in Egypt. When they got to Mount Sinai, what did he make of those people? A nation, right? And so they get ready to go up to receive the land promise. And what do? Yeah, they chicken out. They won't do it, right? So they wander in the wilderness for 40 years. Then they come to the east side of the Jordan, and they're ready to go in. And what character are we introduced to at that point? Actually, we've known him, but now we see him in a different light. Joshua, he is another type of Christ. What does he do? Well, he leads them in conquering the promised land, gives a speech, says, give up those gods that your fathers had on the other side of the river. I'm going to follow God. You should do that too. What do the people say? We will. How long does that last? About a generation. And that brings us into the book of Judges. And what was the book of Judges about? Yeah, well, we didn't get rid of everybody. And boy, when we look around at what they do, their worship sure looks like a lot more fun than ours. So I think I'd rather worship Baal and the Ashtaroth. There's only a problem. When Moses gave the law the second time, there was a chapter 28, 29, and 30 in Deuteronomy. And what did God promise? If you obey me, blessing. If you disobey me, curse. And by the way, it will get worse and worse. How's it going so far? It's getting worse and worse. By the way, who is keeping his promises all the way through all this? God is. We love it when God keeps the positive ones. But he also keeps the curses. God is a God who keeps his word and fulfills his promises. We live in an age, probably it's always been like this, that people want to believe in heaven. But if you don't believe me, go out on the internet. You can find a lot of things written about why there is no hell. But if God said there's a hell, and God says he will send people there who disobey him, what can we take from what we've seen already? He'll keep his promises, okay? Well, the time of the judges was a time when the people would get upset about being punished. They would finally call out to God and say, "We'll follow you again." They'd raise up a judge for them. They would be better for a while, but then they would go back to their old ways, and they would usually be worse the next time around. So by the time we get to the book of Samuel, we find that in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Which is going to be very interesting, because the way the people begin to reason is they look around at the mess they're in, and they don't think about calling on God and following Him and doing what was said in the law. They look around at their situation and they say, "Well, you know, the Ammonites don't seem to have problems getting organized, and the Moabites don't seem to have a problem, and the Egyptians never seem to have a problem getting organized and protecting themselves. I think I know what's wrong here. We are the only group of people around here without a king. And if we had a king, he could go out for us and fight our battles, and he would make everything much better for us, and we would stop being in this unstable situation." So really, do you remember Deuteronomy 17? Another thing that God said would happen. What would the people eventually want? A king. And what did he say? "You can have a king, but you'll have a king." Well, not there. There he said, "You'll set a king over you who is one that I choose. You shall not pick anyone who is not one of your brothers." And there's a whole lot of instructions there about kings, and we'll come back to them. So really, what this Samuel is the story of David. Now, do we think of it that way? Most of the time, I think we say, well, there's United Kingdom and there's Divided Kingdom, and Saul is the first king of the United Kingdom. But if this is a story about Jesus and how God fulfills his promise to bring Jesus along, there was a promise at the end of Genesis about the tribe of Judah. What was said about the tribe of Judah? Obey the scepter forever. Saul doesn't fit that. Now remember, I think when we look at this story, what you're going to see is, if you read your material, you know that Saul is described as being what? By God. He's taller than anybody else. He's better looking than anybody else. Why, he looks like a king. You wanted a king like the nations around you? I found you one right here. And I think this is all preparation for the king that God would want. A man after his own heart who is short and ruddy and a shepherd. Not who you would go out and like, "We want a king like the nations around us. We want to find a short guy to do that." You see, there's just kind of look at this. And so Samuel is the story of David. Quit laughing, Bill. So, but I want you to think about Samuel. Samuel is one of the two or three greatest men of the Old Testament. When Jeremiah was preaching to the people about the fact that Nebuchadnezzar was going to come and carry them away, look at what God said to Jeremiah. "The Lord said to me, though Moses and Samuel stood before me, yet my heart would not turn toward this people." So we don't have a lot on Samuel, but what we do have, we need to look at Samuel as what he was in God's eyes. This was truly a great man. By the way, when the kingdom is ripped away from Saul, watch how Samuel feels and pleads with God for Saul. Who is that like? Jesus and like Moses? And he will be told, like Moses was sometimes, quit talking to me about that. I've already made up my mind. This is done. Go find the next king. So, all right. So, who wrote the book of Samuel? We don't know. However, what we do know is probably this was a compilation of source materials. Take this from 1 Chronicles 29:29, which 1 Chronicles is also the story of David from a different perspective. And it says that the materials that were about David from first to last are written in the chronicles of Samuel the seer. That's interesting. That of Nathan the prophet. We all know about Nathan, right? And Gad. And if you're reading the accounts very carefully, you will see all three of those men being very involved with David. And so it looks like that probably when this was written, from a time perspective, it's speculative, but there's some hints in the text, that this was probably written near the time, the end of Solomon's reign, or right at the beginning of Rehoboam's reign. What seems to be true about it is the post-exilic books will have Aramaic in them. They will be very negative. And Samuel overall is pretty positive about the kingdom and its growth, and it has no Aramaic in it, so it seems like it was written earlier rather than later. Okay? There's also no Chaldean references in it. So if you read Daniel, for example, or you read the Chronicles, you would find those kind of things in it. By the way, do you know what the difference is between 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, and 1 and 2 Samuel? So write this down. So Samuel is all about David. 1 Chronicles is all about David. 1 and 2 Kings, 1 Kings starts with which king? Solomon. What does 2 Chronicles start with? Solomon. So 1 and 2 Kings are the story of how the kingdom went into sin and was eventually carried away into exile. And so the whole point of it was, if you look there, all the sins of all the kings are carefully enumerated, especially idolatry. But Chronicles was written after the captivity, and was written when they came back from exile. And you remember what was the one thing that the Israelites had a problem doing when they came back from exile? They're trying to get the temple built. So if you look at 1 and 2 Chronicles, they're all great stories about the temple and what happened when they went there and when they went before God and they called on Him to help. Because one of the things that people will sometimes notice is 2 Samuel has the story of David and Bathsheba. It's not in Chronicles. And the reason it's not in Chronicles is because they're trying to encourage the people to build the temple and to have faith in God and do what He's asked them to do. So it's all looking at the same time period, but it has different emphasis. Does that make sense? So. Okay. So the purpose. So really the purpose of this book is quite interesting because I think one key purpose is it shows how David became the king. But it tells the story of David's life with the purpose of demonstrating that David was a man after God's own heart and the rightful choice for Israel's throne. Do you think there could be a problem after the Saul's reign that when God chooses David to be king, that some people might question whether it should still be Saul's children that should be king? So there would be some emphasis in here that it's not Saul's lineage that should be king, but David's lineage that should be king. The book is also written to inspire the audience to follow God and obey His laws. Because in the end, God will reward those who obey Him and punish those who turn from Him and flaunt His laws. Is there a better example than the contrast between Saul and David? David followed God's laws, and when he didn't, he was quick to repent and quick to get back on that path. What did Saul do? Made excuses. The people made me do it. So there's a real contrast there that we want to look at. Now, this follows, if you think about it, it's right in line with Deuteronomy. Right? If you obey me, what will I do? I will bless you. If you disobey me, then I will curse you. Do you think there's anything to this that they keep emphasizing that point through these stories? Seems to be pretty consistent. So what are some of the lessons? What are some of the lessons that we will learn in this? So first of all, if David is a type of Jesus, what is one of the things that you see from him consistently in his actions? He's merciful. He's merciful, first of all, with who? Saul himself. And then after Saul dies, how does he treat Ishbosheth and Mephibosheth, sons of Saul? What would an earthly king do? Kill them, right? Because why? They have a claim to the throne. Then obey God, because the consequences of sin are terrible. And if you see the story of David, first you see Saul, who would not obey God, and he falls apart. And the man that we found in the beginning, who was humble, really, he hit in the baggage, folks, when at his coronation. And he went back to his farm after he had been anointed and just picked up and started farming again. Hey, wait, you're the king, right? To a man who wanted to capture Agag so that he would have a trophy king at his table. And he fell away from God. And he disintegrated into a mess. How about David? David is this great and glorious king, and he's on this kind of trajectory. Then he murders Uriah and commits adultery with Bathsheba. And what is the story like for him after that? He's got problems from his sons all the way down to practically the time that he's going to die. He has to end up telling Solomon, you need to take Adonijah out. And this is a man who's pretty merciful. And you can see it in his Psalms as we go through it. That repentance versus is greater than excuses. And I think we see that pretty clearly in here. David has sins, some of which you might consider worse than Saul's. And yet, what does he do? He repents. And then I think there's perseverance and faith in God, because 1 Samuel's mostly about David being a fugitive. And if you read his Psalms when he's in the cave of Adullam, this is a man who believes that God will make everything turn out right in the end, but boy, is he miserable while that's going on. And what can we learn from that? Is life going to be easy? Is God going to fulfill his promises but make it easy for us while that's going on? No, don't think so. So the structure of 1 and 2 Samuel, as you're reading this, look at it like this. Samuel, the first seven chapters are about Samuel becoming the prophet and the judge and replacing Eli. Then we get to Saul being king, and we go through chapter 15 and we see his failure. But then we get to 16 through 20 and we start to see David's rise in popularity. So as Saul is going down, David's going out winning battles. And that was pretty good for Saul at the beginning. But when he heard people singing in the streets that Saul has killed his thousands and David his 10,000s. How did that set with him?
Very jealous,
right? Now, David knows he's going to be king. And there are some discussions between Saul and Jonathan that I think Saul knew that David was going to be king, and Jonathan knew it. But basically, David had to run and hide. The turning point comes in this story when God reverses the fortunes of Saul and David. Saul seeks to kill David, but how God takes care of this is that God sees that Saul is killed and David is put on the throne. Then David's initial rise to power, by the way, was not easy either. You're going to see that he's going to be over Judah, but not over Israel. He has to wait, I think it's 7 years, before the kingdom actually comes to him, and it takes Abner, who is the commander of Saul's forces, to bring Israel in to submit to David. So if you look at this, David's been promised since he was a boy that he would be king. And how long is this going on? Quite a while. And then David's failure is in David and Bathsheba, but it goes on and on because you're going to read about Absalom. You're going to read about Amnon and Tamar. David should have killed his son for what he did with Tamar. But can you imagine what it was like for a man who was guilty of what he had been guilty of and what he had been forgiven of? How could he take that action? But the failure to take that action leads to Absalom's rebellion. Because Absalom's mad. Why haven't you avenged my sister? And Absalom sees David as weak. And David isn't the same kind of king he was before that because he does hesitate. But through it all, he continually shows mercy. And then finally, Solomon, we see 2 Samuel 21 through really 1 Kings 2, Solomon ascends to the throne. So really the outline of 1 Samuel is that chapters 1 through 7 are about Samuel the prophet and judge. Then 8 through 15 are the reign of Saul from the people's request for a king until Saul is rejected by God. And then chapters 16 through 31 show the early life of David and his conflicts with Saul. And if you really watch, the text really does focus more on David from that point on. Okay? So you read the first three chapters of Samuel. What stood out to you? Go ahead.
Well, I just, as a mother, I've always thought it was interesting, and I know this is prophetic and it's the Bible, but it just has been interesting to me that Hannah would give her son to this priest who isn't a very good parent.
Yeah. Which is interesting because for Samuel, Eli turned out to be a good parent for him. Right? Okay. What else stands out?
The genuine faith of Hannah and her husband.
Yeah, I think he gets left out, but if you notice, when it was time to take him, I noticed again today, when it was time to take Samuel, she said, he's not weaned yet. But he makes a statement at the end of when she says, well, he says, do what seems good to you. But he makes a statement about the Lord there. Does anyone see that? Yeah, I think the idea was you made a promise. Hard as that might be, what does she need to do? Fulfill that promise, okay? What do we learn about Eli's family? Diedrich hinted at this or talked about it a little bit.
His son's the priest for.
Yeah, they really weren't good. By the way, did Eli ever say anything to them? Well, I think if you look in the text, he does rebuke his sons. And then when God confronts him about it, what does he say about him and his sons and Eli's relationship to God? So, didn't he rebuke them?
He didn't take the proper action to put a stop to it.
So what's the proper action for the high priest to do to a priest who profanes the tabernacle? Put them to death. Is God serious again about what he says? It was Eli's job to do that. And his failure to do that, what does God say Eli, what Eli's attitude toward God is? Dan, I saw you.
Well, I wonder how much of that they learned from Eli, though, and just took it a step further. Because in the rebuke, God says, you know, you honor your son more than me. To make yourselves fat with the best of all the offerings of Israel, my people, they would take the meat without the fat being burned.
Yep.
A couple chapters later, when Eli dies,
he's fat. It's possible, yeah.
They might have started the process and they just took it
way out beyond that, yeah. But I think the key thing is there, the fact that he did not take them out and did not kill them. God said, you honor them more than you honor me. That's a pretty tough lesson. By the way, who had to confirm all this to Eli? Samuel. You know, that Samuel's first prophecy is what's going to happen to Eli and his sons. And you remember when Eli asked Samuel, don't hold back from me what the Lord said? Did Samuel hold anything back? What was Eli's reaction to it, though? Yeah, if that's what seems good to the Lord, let him do it, right? Okay. Do we see Jesus in this? Go ahead.
At the end of chapter 2, verse 35, it says, and I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who shall do all according to the ways of my heart and mind, and I will build him a sure house, and he shall go in and out before my anointed forever.
That's pretty clear, isn't it? That seems to be Jesus in this passage, okay? All right, so your next reading was 4 through 8. So what stood out to you in chapters 4 through 8? How were they treating the ark?
Like it was an idol.
Yeah, like it was an idol. Yep. How'd that work out for them? They only lost 4,000 in the first battle, I think it was. The second battle, they got wiped out, essentially. By the way, this may be the end of Shiloh as a center of worship. That's how tragic this really was. Really is at this point. So where does the ark go? And so what happens when it, I think it's really interesting because where does it go first? Yeah, what happened there? Yeah, I think it's humorous in a way because they come in the next morning, there's Dagon laying on his face. They have to put him back up. The text is really clear about that, right? They come back the next morning and where do they see? That's right. He has no head and no hands. And they put it back. Now, what happened to the town and the people? Probably something like plague hit them. What do they decide to do? Well, we've had enough of this. Let's send it to our sister city. And how do they feel about it? The first one takes it. And exactly the same things happen there. They get ready to send it to the third city, and they said, whoa, wait a minute. We don't want that thing. What are we going to do with it? So what do the Philistines decide to do? Going to send it home, but they consult their priest, and their priest said, I wouldn't send that home empty-handed. So what do? Well, they made five
golden beavers and golden rats.
So they matched the five cities of the Philistines, right? They also do something else. Yes.
A milking cow that hasn't been pitched, and they put the cows back at home, and they say if it goes the way that we want the ark to go, it was from their God.
Yep. So they removed any, and when they did put it on that cart, and that cow took off, what did it do? I like it. It's lowing all the way. It's announcing it, essentially. And it goes right straight to Beth Shemesh. Now I want you to think you're an Israelite, Beth Shemesh, and you're out harvesting your field. And you see this cart coming with the ark on it, which they may have never seen, by the way. And it's going down that road, boom, 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 you know, like this. And what's the ark? And it's coming up, and that cow is just a cow with an ark coming. What do? Yeah, what was the one thing you were never supposed to do? Never touch it, right? And, you know, think about this. Somebody with really good intentions. Well, you know, those stinking Philistines had this thing for 7 months. Did they leave everything in it? Right? Can you hear somebody saying it? We better check it. And what happens when the men get killed that looked at it in Beth Shemesh? What does Beth Shemesh decide? Yeah, you know, nobody wants this thing now, right? Well, there, the Levites take it and they put it somewhere. Go ahead. Yes. I think it was Amminadab here first? I think it was at the house of Amminadab. It's going to stay there 20 years. That's why I think Shiloh is gone. I just, you know, because what would you have done with it if you'd gotten it back? Where do you think you would have taken it? Back to the tabernacle, right? So, 9 through 12. Now, the people, in chapter 8, the people ask for a king. How does Samuel react to being asked when they ask for a king? Yes. In fact, when you go to his speech in chapter 12, when he begins that speech, how does he start that speech out in chapter 12? I want you to tell me how I've hurt you. What did I ever take from you? Did I ever take bribes? Did I ever take things from you? And what do the people say? No. But we still want what we want. So God tells Samuel, this is a rejection of who? Him as king. And he goes and tells him, go tell him what the king is going to be like. Now, I wish I had more time for this, but think about this. The king's going to take his taxes. And he's going to take your children. And he's going to take your best land. And by the way, did that, by having a king, did that reduce the taxes that were due to the Lord and the tabernacle? Now, what have they done? They've added the burden, right? And boy, in the days of Solomon, it will be a burden, right? So, Saul is told, we get a story about Saul, and then we're told, we see how he comes to Samuel, and we find out that Samuel was told the day before Saul came, I'm going to show you who's coming, but he's coming tomorrow. Now, I really want you to look back at some of the things that Saul comes up to find out, where's my donkeys? Right? And he comes up to Samuel and he says, here is the blessed of all Israel. What? You know? And then he goes to a feast and they put him and his servant at the head of the table and serve him the largest portion. The next morning, Samuel wakes him up, gets him out, going down the door, and you can picture this early morning and Samuel says, tell your servant to get on down the road. I got something to say. I'm going to tell you the word of the Lord. And he breaks out a flask and he starts pouring oil over the top of his head. Tells him, you're going to be king. And Saul's whole reaction to this is, and this is where the end of Judges comes in. I'm from Benjamin, the smallest of all the tribes. Why me? Remember what happened to Benjamin in Judges? And the first city he has to rescue is Jabesh-Gilead, where they killed all the people to get the wives. So the chances are that Saul is related to people in Jabesh-Gilead is pretty high. Right? But the people are pretty excited. Hey, we told you, get a king, lead us out in battle. What happened? We won. So then Samuel's going to give them a speech. And his speech was, you have rejected God. Since all the way back, you have rejected God. And just so you know that this thing is from God, it's the wheat harvest. And here's rain. And when the people were scared, they were going to starve to death because the kind of rain that came was the kind of rain that could have destroyed their wheat harvest. And when Samuel sits right there and goes, it's coming right now. And it happens. And he tells him, gives him a warning right at the end. He says, now let this be the warning. You still need to obey God. Because if you don't obey God, what will happen to you and your king? You'll be swept away. Right? Okay. So pick up on your reading and we're just going to go through and we'll look a little more in depth at the text on Sunday, but I hope this introduction was good and helps out with your reading. Thank you.